I'm going to talk about some work which I've been doing over the last couple of years looking for observational constraints and tests of some certain modified theories of gravity. And I should apologize now, my laptop doesn't seem to like the projector, so it might be slightly slow scrolling through. Okay, so let me tell you what I'm going to talk about in particular. It comes up. There we go. So first of all, I'm going to give you some motivations about why people study modified theories of gravity in general. Then hopefully after I've convinced you that it's a worthwhile field to study, I'm going to talk about why people might want to screen out these modifications of gravity on local scales, and I'm going to introduce you to a specific class of theories which I'm going to discuss for the rest of the talk. From there, I'm going to talk about some theoretical work I've been doing about putting these stars into putting stars into modified gravity and seeing how their properties and features change when we deviate from Einstein's theory. And this is going to be largely theoretical, so I'm going to move on after that, and I'm going to look at how we can use these theoretical predictions to look at distances to distant galaxies and use these to actually constrain these theories of modified gravity. And that's going to be the bulk of the talk. Finally, in the last 5 minutes or so, I'm going to talk about some ongoing work and hopefully convince you that there's still a lot to be done. And then I'll summarize. Okay, so first of all, why would I want to play around with gravity? The fact is that general relativity, as described by Einstein, works incredibly well. It's been tested over the last 100 years and it passes all of our tests. But there are still a few mysteries which we can't quite solve, things like dark matter and dark energy. So some people like to study modified gravity because they view it as an alternative to dark energy. So in particular, we know that the universe is accelerating, and we know that Planck says that 69% of the universe needs to be in something called dark energy in order to account for this. And if you want to account for this in general relativity, you need to modify this side of Einstein's equations. You need to either add a cosmological constant or add some other sort of new degree of freedom, like a scalar field in quintessence. And it turns out that apart from the cosmological constant, if you modify general relativity in any other way, you always necessarily introduce a new degree of freedom. This is a theorem of Weinberg. So some people can turn this argument around and say, well, if we're adding new degrees of freedom here, in some sense, this is equivalent to a modification of gravity. So why don't we play around with this side of the Einstein's equations and see if we can get acceleration that way without using extra scalar fields? And I should say this is a motivation for studying modified gravity in general, just so you feel that I haven't cheated you. It's not a motivation for studying the class of theories which I'm going to talk about, because there's been a very recent result that these can't be dark energy. But this isn't the only reason. Some people are more interested in things like string theory and other beyond the standard model theories of particle physics. And these also introduce new degrees of freedom. So for example, string theory, the four-dimensional Lorentz effective action includes a string dilaton coupled to the Ricci scalar. And this is equivalent to an infrared modification of general relativity. It produces forces on long-range forces. And so some people are interested in studying modified gravity for that reason. As I said, string theory is just one example. I'm talking about any general extension of the standard model always has these particles, and you don't know if you're going to come up with a theory which has long-range forces, and you might need some mechanism to screen them out. I'm not going to talk about actual specific string theory models of these, and it is possible to hide these things in other ways by giving them a mass, and you might expect this to be large due to some dimensional hierarchy. And finally, there's a bit more of an aesthetic reason why people like to study these things, and that's completeness. So far, we've only really tested general relativity in our own solar system. We've tested it in things like Mercury's precession. We've tested it in compact objects like neutron stars. On cosmological scales, that's true, but there's a lot of work at the moment looking at modified gravity in the CMB, and the constraints there aren't that strong. If you allow for a general deviation from general relativity, there's actually quite a wide range of parameter space.
That's true, but it's also true that at some level
you test it in the CMB, yes.
And to an incredible accuracy. In the sense that you're right, if you actually assume quite a few other things, and that's where the freedom you have to modify gravity.
Yes.
But if you assume a lot of things, you have tested GDR to quite
a I guess the way people usually motivate it on cosmological scales, they say that suppose that I parameterize deviations from general relativity, say, I parameterize a generalized Poisson equation and a generalized slip equation. You can have large deviations from GR and still get the same thing. And this is just because they're degenerate with things like anisotropic stress. So the point I wanted to make here was just that you haven't tested general relativity in other galaxies which may be very different from our own, things like dwarf galaxies. These things have very different Newtonian potentials, very different curvatures. And so it's nice to see whether or not there are new features here. Okay, so that's why people study modified gravity. The next question is, The next question really is, now that we've modified gravity, is this viable or not? Are we still going to recover our solar system tests? And the answer is, in general, no. And this is because we've tested gravity to incredibly high accuracies over the last 100 years or so. So just to give one example, suppose that I modify gravity to include what I'm going to call a fifth force, and I'm going to call F5. The Cassini satellite tells me that any fifth force relative to the Newtonian force has to be present at levels less than 10 to the minus 5, and in some cases, less than 10 to the minus 13. So you might say, well, is that it? Have you already failed before you started? Why are you going to study modified gravity? Any deviations are going to be tiny. And it turns out there's a slight caveat to this, and the caveat is the same thing that I mentioned earlier, and that's that all of our tests of gravity have been performed really in our local solar system, which means there's nothing precluding a theory of gravity that, say, is active over very large scales or very different curvatures, provided that it gives me the same experimental tests and satisfies the same experimental constraints when I look at my solar system tests. And theories of gravity which have this property are said to possess what are called screening mechanisms. So really, any viable theory of gravity should have one of these screening mechanisms. So let me just tell you about screening mechanisms in general and how we can screen out fifth forces. So the most generalized thing you can write down is this Lagrangian here. You take some scalar fields, and you couple it to matter, and then you can perturb it to second order in its perturbation delta phi. And the most general thing you can write down is some kinetic term for the perturbation with some non-canonical normalization here. I can write down some effective mass of my scalar field perturbation, and I can write down some coupling to matter with some strength beta. And this is what gives me my fifth forces. So how can I go ahead and screen these out? Well, there are three different ways. I can either make this thing large, because that means when I normalize the field, this coupling is going to be small. I can make the mass very large, because this means that I'm going to have a very, very short range force, and I'm not going to pick it up in solar system tests. Or I can make this coupling to matter very, very small, which essentially means I've decoupled my scalar from the rest of the observable sector. And these screening mechanisms have been very, and these different mechanisms have been studied quite a lot. So if I want to fiddle around with this and have a screening mechanism based on the kinetic term, then this is described by what's called Weinstein screening. If I want to have a large mass, then I can use something called the chameleon mechanism. And if I want to have a small coupling, then I can use something called the symmetron or the dilaton mechanism. And I'm not actually going to talk about Weinstein screening in this talk because it's a very different screening mechanism from these two. I'm going to talk about what are called conformal scalar tensor screening mechanisms, and I'll explain what I mean by conformal very soon, on the next slide, in fact. Right, there we go. So this is the theory which I'm going to consider for the rest of this talk. At face value, it looks a lot like a normal theory of quintessence. So I've got the normal canonical Einstein-Hilbert term, I've got a canonical kinetic term for my scalar field, and I've got a scalar potential. The only difference is that when I write down my matter action, I don't use the metric associated with this Ricci scalar when I do my contractions. I use the conformally rescaled metric by some conformal coupling function, which I'm going to call A of phi, and this is why they're known as conformal screening mechanisms. And this gives a few new novel features to the theory, which wouldn't be there otherwise. So the first one is that you infer the presence of a fifth force. And the reason for this is that because of this coupling here, any particles that respond to this coupling don't actually move along geodesics of the metric described here. They move along what's called the Jordan frame, geodesics of the Jordan frame metric, which is defined over there. And this means that if you observe in the Einstein frame and say, well, actually, I want my particles to move on geodesics of this metric, then I'm going to infer the presence of a fifth force. And this fifth force is given by this expression here. It looks like the gradient of the field times some function here, and this function I've defined there as the logarithmic derivative. The second feature that you get is that the scalar potential which I put in over here is not actually the scalar potential which governs the dynamics of the field. So if I go to the next slide, what you actually get is a scalar potential which looks like this. You get a so-called effective potential. It looks like the scalar field potential plus the density times the coupling function. And this is what allows me to screen out my fifth forces, because now my effective potential depends on where I am in the universe, because where I am in the universe may have different densities. And suppose that I then have a minimum of my effective potential. My scalar field is going to want to minimize this potential in at different field values and different environments. So if I can somehow arrange this effective potential so that the scalar field moves to some advantageous position such that the force is screened, then I can I've effectively screened out my force. And there are two ways which I can do this. I can either move it to a field value such that the mass times whatever length scale is involved in the problem is very large, in which case I've got a submillimeter force and I can't detect it. And this is how the chameleon mechanism works. I can also engineer it so that the coupling to matter beta, which is the same as the strength of this fifth force, is negligible in these dense environments, and this is what happens with the symmetron and the dilaton. In this talk, I'm actually going to use a model-independent parameterization. However, just to give you an example of how this might work, I'll give you the chameleon mechanism in detail. So the way the chameleon mechanism works is I take a runaway potential, which is this blue dashed line here, and I take a monotonically increasing coupling function, which is this red line here, and this gives me some density-dependent field minimum. So if I look at very low densities, this red line is very, very shallow, and you can see the second derivative, the curvature, it's not very sharp at all, and I'm going to get a very, very low mass. If I then move to higher densities, this red line moves up because of the rho term and the effective potential, and as you can see, this potential really is, it's a lot steeper, and you're going to get a much larger mass. And these theories have become quite interesting over the last few years, because it turns out that if you want to study F of R gravity, depending on your choice of F, is equivalent to a chameleon. And a lot of people are interested in these theories because a lot of people are interested in F of R, and F of R needs to satisfy local solar system tests. Okay. So that's all very well and good, but the question is, when can I screen an object and when can't I screen it? So there are really two situations which you need to bear in mind. Just because the field can, in principle, minimize its potential doesn't mean that it does. So the idea is I can have a screen situation where my field starts off at some very large value, some value far away from the object. As it comes in, it can minimize its effective potential effectively over the entire range of the object, in which case you're going to get no fifth forces here. You're only going to get a variation in a very thin shell, and your forces are going to be screens. If, on the other hand, you've got, say, a very small object and the field can't reach its minimum effectively, you may very well get a large region here where the object is unscreened. And it turns out it's actually the surface Newtonian potential which decides whether an object is screened or not, and I'm going to make that more precise in a second. But just for now, I'd like you to bear in mind the following picture. Very far away from the object, the field reaches its cosmological value or its value in whichever medium into which this object is embedded. At some radius RS, the screening radius, the field can minimize its effective potential, and this is where I'm at an advantageous position. I can screen out my fifth forces. But somewhere in between, there's going to be some shell where the field varies, and this is going to be unscreened, and it's going to give me large fifth forces. So let me introduce you to the parameterization, which I'm going to use for the rest of this talk. This is a model-independent parameterization, which makes it perfect for astrophysical tests, because astrophysical tests aren't very good at probing specific parameters. They're good at saying whether they're screened or not. So there are two functions I've told you about. I've told you about the scalar potential, and I've told you about the coupling function, which tells you how well you're coupled to matter, which means I should have two parameters being describing my theory in general. So the two parameters I'm going to use are alpha, which is defined as 2 times the coupling in the background squared, and this tells me how strong my force enhancement is when I'm unscreened. So for a good rule of thumb is, if my object is completely unscreened, there's no screening radius whatsoever, then I can model this by G changing to G into 1 plus alpha. And just to give you a sense of the number, F of R gravity has alpha as a third. You can, in theory, go a lot higher, but in this talk, I'm only going to talk about F of R gravity just to give it, just to have something familiar to compare to. The second parameter is what I'm going to call chi zero, which is defined here. It's the field value in the background divided by the coupling in the background. And for those of you who work on F of R theory, this is what's sometimes called FR zero, but in this talk I'm going to refer to it as chi zero completely. And this is what's known as the self-screening parameter. So this parameter tells me how good an object is at screening itself. And the rule of thumb is, if my parameter chi zero is larger than my surface Newtonian potential, then my object is going to be partially unscreened. If I take the converse relation and find that chi zero is less than the surface Newtonian potential, this object will be very good at screening itself and you wouldn't expect any fifth forces. So you might wonder why I've been calling this the self-screening parameter and not the screening parameter. And the reason is there's also an effect from environmental screening. So suppose that I take an object that would be unscreened and I put it here. Its Newtonian potential is quite low, so it can't screen itself. But then suppose I take a much larger object, say a very large galaxy, and I put it next to it. This very large galaxy may have a large Newtonian potential, and this galaxy here can be screened by the Newtonian potential of the large galaxy. So you need to worry about environmental effects as well. So just to give you an example, suppose that I take a dwarf galaxy, which would be unscreened at these values here. If I slowly increase my external Newtonian potential to orders of, say, the Milky Way, then even though this thing could be unscreened if it were by itself, it would be screened by its environment. So let me give you just a flavor of some of the numbers we're dealing with to give you some intuition about the sort of tests we need to do. So the first thing you can consider is very large values of chi0 of order 10 to the minus 4 to 10 to the minus 5. And at these values, you get large unscreened forces on cosmological scales. And this means that if you do things like n-body codes, you find there are large deviations in things like the matter power spectrum, the velocity power spectrum, the halo power spectrum, the mass function. And you can go and compare these to observations. You can go and do cluster constraints. And the number you get out is that chi0 has to be roughly less than 10 to the minus 5 if you want to match to current observations. So what sort of objects do I need to look at if I want to consider smaller numbers than this? Well, the Newtonian potential of... Oh, sorry, question.
So the self-screening has to do with the self-interaction of your phi, right?
Yes.
But it's all embedded in V to the, what you call the effect of the phi.
Yes.
And the environmental screening has everything to do with the coupling to the energy momentum tensor.
Yes.
Of the rest.
Yep.
But you could have derivative interactions for phi, which could be pretty strong, but will not show up, right? Because
It is possible to generalize these to derivative interactions, and there is a model which does this actually. And what tends to happen is you tend to get a slight suppression in your force. So, for example, if I were to include a derivative interaction, essentially you could always move to a frame where your field is canonically normalized. In which case, let me just get back to it.
No, what do you mean? Your field is already canonically normalized. You have a normal kinetic term, but now you add an interaction term, which is derivative.
Oh, a derivative interaction for the field connected to other things.
Right, just the field with itself.
So things like d mu phi squared.
Something like that, right?
Yes, I think that hasn't been investigated fully. There's one paper which looks at things like KS and screening, and they find that you can't get a chameleon for it, but I think they can get a Weinstein mechanism for it. I haven't read that paper in detail, so I don't know the technical details, but I'm just remember that was the conclusion.
I think that generally what happens when you have massive gravity, for example.
Yes, massive gravity and the decoupling limit is a Galileo, and it exhibits Weinstein screening. So anything like that won't be covered by these constraints, because Weinstein screening is a lot more efficient than this. There's a lot harder to find observational tests.
But it's essentially because your chi naught is all coming from the self interactions and the potential, from things like phi the force, phi cube.
Why do you say that?
Your self screening parameter has to do with.
Oh right, I see. Okay, so yes, it's true that in things like the chameleon mechanism, the reason you get a large mass is because you've got a very strongly coupled V of phi at very small values, yes. In something like the Scimitron mechanism, this might not be the case. In the Scimitron mechanism, it's a combination of both. Really, the Newtonian potential appears because you don't just need to be in a dense environment, you need to be in a large enough environment such that your field can effectively minimize its potential. So really, your Newtonian potential is just a measure of that. Right, okay. So the Newtonian potential of main sequence stars like the Sun and also our own galaxy, the Milky Way, is of order 10 to the minus 6. And this means that if I want to probe values between 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 6, I need to look at objects like spiral galaxies and main sequence stars. So you might immediately say, well, hang on a second. We live in a spiral galaxy. We live right next to a main sequence star. Should we automatically impose chi0s less than 10 to the minus 6 in order to be compatible with solar system tests? And the answer is, there's a get-out clause to this as well. It's not necessarily so. And the reason is that Our own galaxy is surrounded by other galaxies in the local group. These have a large Newtonian potential, and it's not clear whether we're screened by our own galaxy or whether we're screened by galaxies in the local group. And people used to argue about this for a while. So this is one of the issues I want to address in this talk. I want to provide a new constraint on chi0 less than 10 to the minus 6 using a test in a different galaxy, so without invoking this local group screening. If you want to test down to values less than 10 to the minus 6, you need to start looking at post-main sequence stars. Post-main sequence stars, like red giants, have the same mass as their progenitor, but they have larger radii. They have radii 10 to 100 times larger. And so for this reason, they can probe field values down to 10 to the minus 7, to 10 to the minus 8.
That's also true for pre-main sequence.
That's true. Pre-main sequence stars, we haven't thought about at all.
They live much longer, much shorter lifetime.
Yes. The other thing is you need to be, as a point I'll make in a minute, you always need to make observations outside the galaxy, because our own galaxy has to be screened one way or another. So these stars can be resolved in other galaxies, and this is why we like to look at these. So these roughly probe 10 to the minus 7. And then you can say, is there anything that can probe even lower values? And the answer is yes, there are dwarf galaxies. So the second issue I want to address is whether we can put new constraints using post-main sequence stars. And to do this, we are going to utilize dwarf galaxies. So dwarf galaxies are great for modified gravity because their Newtonian potential is of order 10 to the minus 8. This means they show new and interesting dynamics themselves, but it turns out that these aren't quite compatible with the data's not good enough. They're not compatible with that. They're not competitive with other constraints. So we're not going to use them to actually place constraints. However, we are going to use them as laboratories, because if I take an object that would be unscreened and put it into a screened galaxy, it's going to be screened. But if I put it into a dwarf galaxy, which is sitting by itself in a void, it's going to be unscreened. So the basic idea when I want to do tests of these sort of modified gravity theories is I split my dwarf galaxies into two samples. I split them into voids where they're sitting by themselves, they're not environmentally screened, and they're going to show new novel features. I then split into another box, which is going to be screened, and I compare the two properties and I say, are they the same or do they see some sort of systematic offset? Yes, you had a question?
They're not identical because of tidal interaction.
Yes, that's true. We're not going to look at the dynamics of dwarf galaxies, and you expect, say, if you put, say, a pulsating star like a Cepheid into a dwarf galaxy in a void or a dwarf galaxy into a cluster, the environmental effects shouldn't affect it that much. The other thing we're going to look for is systematic offsets, so lots of galaxies in voids, lots of them in clusters, and you would hope that this might help beat down your systematics in terms of other effects. But it's true there are degeneracies with other astrophysical effects as well, and this is something which you need to take into account. And when we do this in general, you always put in random systematics and you always check your figures to make sure that there aren't big overlaps there. And we will be doing that. Okay. So that's the main idea of how you want to test for these theories of modified gravity. Let me just tell you quickly what I want to talk about for the rest of the talk. It shows up. I want to look at two questions. Number one, can we finally settle this local group screening argument? Can we place constraints chi0 less than 10 to the minus 6 independently of our own galaxy? And also, can we use post-main sequence stars to place other effects? Okay, so this brings me to the next section, stars in modified gravity. And the main idea before you get involved in any math at all is very simple. What is a star? A star is a big ball of hydrogen gas. It wants to collapse under its own gravity, and somehow it needs to prevent itself from collapsing. It does this by burning fuel, hydrogen fuel, at its center. This releases energy, and it reaches some sort of equilibrium situation because this fuel burning produces an outward pressure. So what happens if I now take a star and put it into modified gravity in an unscreened environment? Well, this means that in the outer layers, I'm going to get enhanced gravitational forces, and so my gravitational collapse is going to be stronger. This means if I want to stave off my gravitational collapse, I need to burn more fuel, and I need to burn more fuel per unit time. This means I'm going to release more energy. This means I expect my star to be brighter, I expect it to be slightly more compact, and I expect it to have a higher surface temperature. The other thing I'd expect, which I'm not going to talk about today, is that the star will also die faster because it's only got a limited amount of fuel at fixed mass. So let's have a look at how we do this in practice. In practice, we need to look at the equations governing stellar structure. And there are four of these, but only one of them is important. And this is what's called the hydrostatic equilibrium equation. And this equation says if I've got something, some ball of gas being supported by pressure against gravity, I need to satisfy this equation, and I need to satisfy this equation at every point in time. Otherwise, I'm either going to expand or contract. Did you have a question?
It will also reach main sequence faster, right?
Sorry?
It will also reach main sequence.
Yes, that's true. I can model that effect numerically, that is included. But for the moment, I'm just going to talk about main sequence stars. And the main point of this part of the talk is to get some sort of physical intuition for how stars work in modified gravity, and then I'm going to embed the whole thing in numerics and get a complete prediction.
Sorry, just Robert Boyce, do you control the things like nebulosity?
In this model, I'm not going to, and I'm going to state my assumptions very clearly. The whole point of this simple analytic model is just to get an analytic handle on what's happening in the physics. Later on, we're going to have complete control over everything. So the main idea is, if I change gravity, this is the only equation which is going to change. It's the only equation which depends on gravity. The other three care about mass conservation, nuclear physics, and quantum physics. So that's not going to change and modify gravity. So the only thing I need to do is modify this equation here. But before I do that, you can get some good physical intuition just by using some simple scaling arguments, because it turns out the equations of stellar structure are what are called self-similar. And this means that if I want to investigate some useful characteristic quantities, say the central pressure here, I can rescale all of my quantities, the pressure, say, by some dimensionless quantity multiplied by the quantity I'm interested in. I can put them into the hydrostatic equilibrium equation, and I get out what are called scaling relations. So I don't get exact answers, but I can know exactly how one quantity scales when I vary the others. So usually you treat G as a constant in this, but we're interested in modified gravity. So I'm going to do the same thing, and I'm going to let G be a variable, and I'm going to use a scaling argument to get out some new scaling relations. And these are the relations I get here. So I could then say, well, what happens if I increase my G by a factor of 1 plus alpha, say my star's completely unscreened? Well, it turns out there are two sources of pressure in a star, gas and radiation pressure. Gas pressure is just the ideal gas law, which is here. Radiation pressure occurs because radiation being released inside the star can be reabsorbed and used to provide an outward pressure. So if I take gas pressure, then it turns out that the luminosity of a star scales like g to the power of 4. And this means if I take a star in modified gravity and compare its luminosity relative to the same star at fixed mass in general relativity, my star is going to be brighter by a factor of 1 plus alpha to the power of 4. And this is a big effect. If I take alpha as a third in, say, f of r gravity, then 1 plus alpha to the 4 is 3.16. You're going to get a very big enhancement. At slightly higher mass stars, which are mainly supported by radiation pressure, you get a bit of a turn-off. It's only 1 plus alpha, and this is because you're absorbing the extra radiation. Yeah, question?
But is this alpha really a constant, or does it change itself as a function of radius?
In the general case, it changes as a function of radius. So what I'm doing here is just considering the completely unscreened case just to get some intuition, and then I'll let it vary as a function of radius slightly later on. So yes, you do expect to see a slight diminishing effect due to that. But it generally turns out that the corrections come in an order screening radius divided by the radius cubed. So if you're relatively unscreened, this is always not the largest effect, except at the surface. So as I said, this is a very, very simple argument. We haven't actually solved any equations. We haven't done anything interesting. So let me go to a slightly more generalized model. Yeah.
What about Earth? Do we have such an insight on the planets? Do we have such a screening on the planets also?
Generally, planets are quite dense, so you'd expect not. In our own solar system, the planets will always self-screen as well, so you can do atmospheric tests and you can do space-based tests. I would guess that actually planets aren't as dense as stars, so you may very well find that they are unscreened in dwarf galaxies, and you may find that the orbits are affected by fifth forces. However, this is very, very hard to observe because you need to. You need to look at dwarf galaxies again, and you need to be able to resolve individual objects. And this tends to be the problem with unscreened objects. You need to look at very bright ones.
But I mean, if it's screened by the galaxy, then you should define a new gravitational constant. You are scaling your gravitational constant by 1 plus alpha.
Yes. In the completely unscreened environment. Sorry?
So what's the Newtonian gravitational constant we are measuring?
If you're in the unscreened case, it would be 1 plus alpha. If you're in the screened case, say you want to do a test around our own planet, then you're going to measure G because our own planet's going to be very, very screened. Another way of thinking about this is that chi0 depends on the values in the background. But if you're looking in a screen planet, chi0 goes down dramatically because your background is already screened. So really, you're looking at chi0 as on like 10 to the minus 13 in our own solar system if you want to look at effects on planets. So it's very, very small. You can look at lab tests, and sometimes if you get very, very rapid density changes, you can get some lab tests, but they're not competitive with these. Right, I've gone down too far. Okay, so in a very simple model, I'm going to use the Lane-Enden equation, the Lane-Enden model, and that's as follows. You take the pressure as a sum of radiation and gas, and it ends up looking like what's called a polytropic equation of state. P is proportional to the density to some number, and this number is 4/3 for main sequence stars. So this model makes a lot of approximations. It doesn't have any nuclear burning. It doesn't include time evolution of the star. There's no mass loss, no convection, no rotation, no radiative effects. So in general, what we could do is update the hydrostatic equilibrium equation to include the full radial dependence, which is given by 1 minus the mass inside the screening radius divided by the mass at some radius r. And this is equivalent to what some people would call the scalar charge. But actually, in light of these approximations, we actually make the approximation that there's no radial dependence of g. However, we don't change g throughout the whole star. We only change it at a radius greater than the screening radius. And as I said, that's quite a good approximation throughout most of the star, but you need to worry about surface effects because this is where this approximation really breaks down. So the way we deal with this is that when we calculate the luminosity, assuming a constant opacity, we don't use the full value of alpha, we use the corrected value of alpha at the surface. So I'm not going to go through all the technical details because it's quite long and annoying, so I'm just going to tell you the general strategy. You solve the modified Lane-Enden system and the scalar field, and you do this for lots of stars of lots of different masses and lots of different values of chi0. In theory, you could vary alpha as well, but I'm just going to show the result for f of r theory, alpha's a third. You can then calculate the luminosity using these approximations and fit it as a function of mass and chi0. And this is what you end up with. It shows up. Okay, so let me just take a bit of time to explain the features of this plot. On this axis here, we have the log of the stellar mass, so 10 to the 2 is about here. This part is slightly unphysical, but we just wanted to show this turn off in detail. On the vertical axis, we're showing the luminosity of a star in modified gravity compared to a star in general relativity for different screening parameters. So we've got 10 to the minus 6, 5 times 10 to the minus 6, 10 to the minus 5, and 10 to the minus 4. So first of all, you can see at 10 to the minus 6, there's not much of an enhancement. And this is just what I told you before. The Newtonian potential at the surface of a main sequence star is of order 10 to the minus 6, so we don't expect a lot of unscreening. Yeah.
So the y-axis, so it's very hard to read. But
yeah, sorry, this plot is incredibly annoying. I can't seem to enlarge the axis, no matter how much I try.
But the units are what?
A
ratio of...
This is the ratio of the luminosity of a star in modified gravity. With that fixed mass in general relativity, yes. So we've got 5 times 10 to the minus 6 here, and you can see there's a bit of an enhancement. And at 10 to the minus 5 and 10 to the minus 4, there's a very large enhancement. And you can see it asymptotes to some value here. And it asymptotes to 3.16. And this is what I told you before. If you take 1 plus alpha when alpha is a third and raise it to the power of 4 for gas pressure, you get a factor of 3.16. So it confirms our simple arguments before. And what's happening here? Why is it saturating? Well, at these very, very large values, the star is completely unscreened at these low masses. And for that reason, you can't get blood out of a stone if it's unscreened completely. You can't unscreen it more, and you're reaching the maximum enhancement here. This turn-off in the enhancement is due to the astrophysical effects I described before. Higher mass stars tend to burn on radiation pressure. Radiation pressure doesn't give you as much an enhancement, so the enhancement at light for high-mass stars is not so great. Okay. So as I've said already, this is a very, very simple model. You can't go out and compare to observations because it's just not complete enough. So what we've done is, yeah.
So do you have a power diagram?
Sorry? I'm going to show you one on the next slide. And as I said, you can't produce an HR diagram because the simple model was just a ball of gas collapsing under its own gravity. But there are lots of good stellar structure codes out there, and there's a particularly good one called MESA, which is very user-friendly. It's open source software, and they encourage people to modify it for their own use. So what I've done is I've modified it to include the effects of modified gravity, and the way I do this is I include the full radial dependence by changing g throughout the star. We solve for the screening radius for given values of chi zero, and we can then evolve completely. So I'm not going to go through the numerical details of that, because again, it's quite technical and boring. I'm going to show you the results. And the nicest results are things like modified HR diagrams. So for those of you who aren't used to HR diagrams, Hertzsprung-Russell diagrams, this is what astronomers use quite a lot. So we've got the log of the surface temperature, which increases inwards on this axis, and the log of the luminosity, the brightness of the star, increases here. So what I've done with this plot is I've put in a star of one solar mass. And the first plot you can look at is the general relativity plot. And this is the black curve here. So it starts off here in the zero age main sequence, it evolves along, and then it slowly, its Newtonian potential decreases and it becomes a red giant here. Then I can turn on modified gravity and I can say, well, what happens at 10 to the minus 7? At 10 to the minus 7, the main sequence is screened because its Newtonian potential is 10 to the minus 6. But as my star evolves, the Newtonian potential slowly decreases, the star becomes increasingly unscreened, and you can see the star is indeed brighter in the red giant phase. At 10 to the minus 6, which is this blue line here, you get a bit of an enhancement on the main sequence phase, and then a very large enhancement on at the red giant phase. And then by the time I'd gotten around to completing this code and testing it, 10 to the minus 4 and 10 to the minus 5 were very well ruled out. But just for fun, to see what would happen, I put in a 10 to the minus 4 value, and what you get is a curve like this. This curve looks very, very different. In fact, it looks a lot more like a two solar mass star than a one solar mass star. And this is a nice way of thinking about the effects of modified gravity. They make light stars look heavier. So the main sequence is still here in the red giant phase. It's completely unscreened.
Is this a specific chameleon or Zemetron model you
have here? No, this is the completely general one. So I'm solving.
It's just the general alpha.
Sorry?
It's just the general.
Oh, sorry, alpha. Yes, alpha is always going to be a third throughout this. So this is for f of r gravity again. You could increase the size of these effects by increasing alpha if you wanted to. And we will place constraints on alpha, but for the purpose of illustration, I always like to compare to f of r gravity. Okay. Right, so this is quite a powerful tool which we can use to then go out and compare to observations, because we can make realistic predictions. And as Renee said, we can change the starting initial metallicity, we can compare with degeneracies like that, we can control overshooting and things like that. Yeah.
So I just want to say, that wasn't an HR diagram, that's what you showed is not observable.
Yeah, that's true. So, okay, I should really call it, I've taken to calling them HR tracks. If you wanted to be a very, very strict astrophysicist, then you would actually take lots of different stars at fixed time, and you would get a curve which looks slightly different. I'm going to always plot the tracks of single stars because this allows us to get some more intuition. But it is possible, and I have looked at creating isochrones, and you can do it, and the modified isochrones do the same thing as these tracks. Okay, so the way I'm going to compare to observations is I'm going to compare using distance indicators. So the idea is as follows. Suppose I want to make some sort of astronomical measurement of how far a distant object like a galaxy is away from me. I need to do some sort of experiment, which means I need some set of observational variables. And I'm not going to worry about what these are. I'm going to call them some set of variables X. So they could be things like luminosity, they could be things like color, they could be things like some standard distance, something, some standard ruler, some standard candle. It could be the flux measured through one of your measuring devices, doesn't matter. But I can convert these fluxes, these sets of measurements to distances using either an analytic relation or some empirically calibrated relation for finding the distance. So the idea is, suppose that then I try and measure my distance to an unscreened galaxy in modified gravity. If I use the general relativity formula and modified gravity changes this formula, I'm going to get the wrong distance. If I'm going to get the wrong distance, then if I compare the distance which from a screened indicator, which does give the general relativity results, to the distance found using an unscreened distance indicator, I should see some sort of difference between the two. So let me give you a very simple example, luminosity distance. So the way I calculate luminosity distance is I say, well, I need to measure the flux at some wavelength or some integrated flux, call it F. And this thing's fixed by my experiment. It's not changed by gravity or modified gravity. This is just something which I measure. I then need another piece of information if I want to calculate the distance. I need the luminosity. And I find this using a standard candle, so I use something like a tip of the red giant branch or a supernova, something where I can say, if I measure a specific quantity, I know its luminosity. But then suppose this thing changes in modified gravity and it gets larger. If I then put in the lower value of the luminosity from general relativity, I'm going to get the wrong value of the distance and it's going to be lower in order to give me the same flux. So this is one way in which modified gravity can affect distance measurements. So let me introduce you to the three. So the main idea is I'm going to compare distances to screened using screened indicators, and I'm going to tell you exactly which indicators are screened in a minute. I'm going to compare them to unscreened distance indicators, which are affected by modified gravity. And the deviation between the two is going to allow me to place new constraints. Okay, so let me introduce you to the three indicators that I'm going to use. The first one are what are called water masers. So these are balls of H2O gas which orbit the central black hole in galaxies. They orbit with a period of a few days, which allows us to make lots of measurements. Galactic processes emit particles which hit this water, cause stimulated emission, and it mazes at 22 gigahertz, and you can measure these lines and make measurements from that. And these sit near the black hole. They're very, very close to the center of the galaxy. So for this reason, they're a screen distance indicator. The Newtonian potential is of order 10 to the minus 5. So as long as we look at chi zero less than this, we can treat this thing as screened. And as I already said, chi zero is 10 to the minus 5 is already ruled out. So this is a sensible thing to do. The actual measurement is very nice and clean. It's very geometric. You've got something orbiting the central black hole. You measure the lines. Using this, you can measure the velocity and the acceleration, which means that you can use the simple Keplerian law to get this distance r. You can also measure the angle on the sky, which allows you to get this distance here. I should say now that when I talk about distances, I'm going to talk about very nearby distances, so distance indicators in the nearby universe, and this means that we don't have to worry about things like cosmological effects and degeneracies with that. Okay, so this is the screen distance indicator. Now we need one which is unscreened. So the one which is unscreened, which I'm going to talk about first, is tip of the red giant branch distances. And tip of the red giant branch distances use essentially the turn-off.
Why was that a screen distance indicator? Because that doesn't the radius of the orbit also depend on the potential?
Yes, but we assume that any fifth force is screened out because it's got a very, very it's living in a very, very high Newtonian potential environment. So any fifth forces should be screened out. So when I take a post-main sequence star of, say, two solar masses, this thing evolves up the red giant branch, and as this happens, it's burning hydrogen in a very thin shell outside its core. When this happens, hydrogen is converted to helium, it's dumped onto the core contracts so it gets hotter. Then as soon as it reaches a set temperature, 10 to the 8 Kelvin, it can then ignite helium, and it suddenly undergoes a big discontinuity in the HR diagram. So I've got this plotted here. So what I'm showing is another track in the HR diagram, but just using different units. So this is what's known as V minus I. This is essentially the effective temperature. And this is called the I band magnitude. So it's the flux at some frequency, 8 to 10 gigahertz. So this is the red giant branch here. These stars climb up the red giant branch. They suddenly reach this point here. At this point here, they suddenly move somewhere down here, which isn't shown on the plot. And this is because their properties change very rapidly because helium ignition starts. And the idea is that this line here is very, very robust. It's fixed by nuclear physics, so no matter what the mass of my star is, it always turns off. It always jumps off there. And the reason for this is that the helium ignition temperature is set by nuclear physics. It's not set by gravitational physics at all. We expect this to be robust against modified gravity. Okay.
So why did we change the helium abundance?
Sorry?
Why did we change the helium abundance?
Well, what do you mean if you change the helium abundance?
Well, I mean, So if you change the properties of the stars, then these tracks would be different. So you say that the metallicity doesn't change it as far as I can tell.
Yes, the offsetting metallicity is only 0.1. So actually, we're going to find there is an effect on this, which might be slightly counterintuitive. And yes, you're right, it won't be able to reach as far as
the
giant branch.
So I'm asking about the helium abundance. If you change Y, would this change?
The helium abundance, all the chemical abundances change slightly. Okay. It's actually quite a small effect, especially at low chi zero. Let me just show that in more detail. So the idea is that if I go out and measure a cluster of stars, I can look for this line. If I find a star at this line and want to measure its flux, I also know its luminosity, therefore I can calculate its luminosity distance. So as I said, you'd expect it to be robust against modified gravity, but that's not quite true. And the reason is, suppose that I raise my screening VAT parameter to very high values, say greater than 10 to the minus 6, and my core becomes unscreened. This means that my hydrogen shell burns at a faster rate, it deposits more helium at a faster rate, and so the time it takes for my star to reach a temperature of 10 to the 8 Kelvin and burn helium decreases. So my star can't get as far as up the red giant branch as it used to be able to. And for this reason, the peak luminosity, the tip of the red giant luminosity, actually goes down in modified gravity, which is slightly counterintuitive compared to what I told you before. So essentially, we're interested in two regimes here. If chi zero is less than 10 to the minus 6, the tip of the red giant branch distance indicator is a screen distance indicator, and this is what we found numerically using MESA. The core is screened. If I take larger values than this, the core is unscreened, the tip of the red giant branch luminosity goes down, and this is an unscreened distance indicator. So now we've got two distance indicators. We've got a screened one, water masers, this is always screened, and we've got one which is unscreened for chi zero is greater than 10 to the minus 6. So comparing these two distances, we can constrain this parameter range. So we can do this using one galaxy. And this galaxy has been found to be unscreened using some recent results by a group working at Penn and a group working at Portsmouth. So some people in Portsmouth very recently have come up with screening maps. They've used SDS data calibrated on modified gravity n-body codes. And they can classify galaxies either screened or unscreened. And they've got a nice set of maps. They've got maps for 10 to the minus 7, 10 to the minus 6, and 10 to the minus 5. And they can use these to actually pick out galaxies in the SDS survey and say whether they're going to be screened or not at specific chi zero. So it turns out that we've only got one galaxy which is unscreened at these values of chi zero, and this is this galaxy here, NGC 4258. And this is a spiral galaxy, it's not a dwarf galaxy. So it's got Newtonian potential of order 10 to the minus 6, but because we're looking at values greater than 10 to the minus 6, this thing should be unscreened, and indeed the screening map says this. So we can compare the two MESA distance estimates, which agree very well, with the tip of the red giant branch estimate. And as you can see, within errors, they agree to very, very high precision. If my tip of the red giant branch distance were to become unscreened, we would be looking at differences of order 10% to 20%. So this really is a very big difference compared to these precisions. And this agreement sets a new constraint. It constrains chi zero less than 10 to the minus 6. So this is an independent constraint compared to the argument that our local group can screen us. And we've been able to sort that issue out. Unfortunately, we can't go lower because it's a spiral galaxy. And also, we've only got one of them, so we're slightly data limited. So we need slightly better data and a different distance indicator if we want to probe lower values. So the final distance indicator I'm going to talk about are Cepheid distances. So what are Cepheid distance indicators? Well, they're stars of, say, 5 to 10 solar masses. They start off here on the zero-age main sequence. They evolve along. They move up to the giant phase. And then they go through these loops. And it turns out that when these loops cross this little band here, known as the instability strip, doubly ionized helium has a process which means these stars are unstable to Cepheid pulsations. So it turns out that if I've got a layer of doubly ionized helium, when I compress my star, the energy doesn't go into raising the temperature and pressure and pushing me backwards again. It goes into ionizing this helium, and so I can keep doing it, and so I get this pulsation effect. And you can use these as distance indicators because there's a well-known period luminosity relation. So hopefully that should be on the next slide. The period of a Cepheid star is proportional to 1 over the square root of g times the density. And this is why we can use it to test modified gravity. The fact we've got a factor of g there means that if we change g, we should change our Cepheid distance. So in astrophysical terms, the relation looks like this. There's something called the bolometric magnitude. That's equal to some constant times the log of the period, plus some constant times this thing, b minus v, plus some other calibration constant. And I know there are a lot of theorists, and I'm a theorist myself, so if you're a theorist like me, this doesn't mean much to you. So let's just translate that back into theory terms quickly. This thing essentially is the flux, so it looks like the log of the luminosity. The period looks like 1 over the square root of the density, so this thing looks like the log of the radius. This thing is proportional to the log of the surface temperature. And so if I recombine this all, I end up with L equals 4 pi r squared sigma t to the 4. So it's just the Stefan Boltzmann law in disguise. So what happens in modified gravity? Well, I've already said if you change g, you change the period. What happens when we do this? Well, we can now see what happens when we change our period. How is this going to affect the change in our distance? And the result we get is this delta d over d looks like minus 0.3 delta g over g. And this allows us to make some quantitative prediction. So the idea is we calculate the average value of the new gravity numerically using MESA, and we use this formula to calculate the change in the distances. So I've already said that when chi zero is less than 10 to the minus 6, the tip of the red giant branch is screened. Cepheids aren't, and this means that I can use the tip of the red giant branch distance as my distance in general relativity, and which means that this thing, delta D, is actually D Cepheids minus D tip of the red giant branch, and so I can use these two distance indicators to constrain modified gravity. So let's look at what happens when we go out and do this. So we go out and we take data from this screening map for the different, this one shows 10 to the minus 6, and we look at which galaxies are going to be screened, which ones aren't screened. We look for simultaneous tip of the red giant branch and Cepheid distances, and we compare the two. So the first thing you can say is, well, there should be a change in the period luminosity relation. Let's see what happens when we look at that between a sample of screened and unscreened galaxies. So in these plots, black are a screened set of galaxies, which can include spirals and environmentally screened dwarfs. Unscreened galaxies are the red ones. These are dwarf galaxies in voids. So as you can see, there's a lot of scatter. If you plot the period luminosity versus its magnitudes, there's not much sign for any deviation there. Any deviation is really going to be statistical. And you can see this again by binning these. So if you bin them into different magnitude ranges, you can see that the error bars are all completely consistent. There's no obvious difference between the two. So let's actually look at what happens when we compare the distances. If you plot D Cepheid, which is modified gravity on the vertical, and D tip of the red giant branch, which is general relativity on the horizontal, you can see it pretty much lies on the straight line here. So again, there's not much evidence at all. Anything's really going to be statistical. So that's what we do. We do a chi-square fit, and we look at different models, and that's shown here. So on the left, we're plotting delta D over D, which should be zero in general relativity. And we're plotting this as a function of D general relativity, and this just allows us to get flat lines. It makes the plot nice to interpret. So the black dashed line here is the best fit for the screened sample, and the red line here is the fit for the unscreened sample. And this little band here is just the two sigma contours. So what would we expect from modified gravity? Well, if we take alpha as a third f of r gravity, we expect this solid green line here. And if we take an even stronger fifth force enhancement, we expect this dashed line here. So as you can see, modified gravity is very, very at odds with the best fit models. So there's not going to be a very, very... we should be able to get a tight constraint from that. For those of you who mentioned before things like metallicity degeneracies, we have taken all that into account. We've done them. We've put in random sources of error. We've checked with metallicity calibrations and things like that. And any change actually pulls your best fit this way. So it pulls it away from the direction of modified gravity, which is good. It means this test is robust against degenerate effects like that. So let me show you the actual numerical results after we've done this. So what I'm plotting now is alpha along the bottom, chi zero along the top, and the one and two sigma contours. So this black line is the previous constraint coming from cosmology, and this 10 to the minus 6 line is the previous hand-wavy constraint coming from screening arguments, or slightly more robust, using water maser distances. And as you can see, we can constrain a very large region of parameter space. Very, very high, strong couplings tend to be ruled out. And I should say that if you go and look at lab tests, because lab tests aren't actually optimized for testing these models, you tend to find that couplings of order 10 to the 9 are allowed. These astrophysical constraints do a very good job at beating lab tests by constraining alpha. In terms of chi zero, we've still got a bit of parameter space down here to rule out. We've done a very good job. And for f of r gravity, the value that we're quoting is less than 4 times 10 to the minus 7. So this means if you impose these constraints, the only effects you get of these theories are on very, very large Cepheids, 10 solar mass Cepheids, and dynamics of dwarf galaxies. Everything else is now constrained. The final thing I should mention is that we're slightly data limited, so you might wonder why these curves are quite jagged and why there are little bumps here. And this is because the data is not optimized for modified gravity, because we don't always have simultaneous and Cepheid distances. It means it's very sensitive to changing chi zero. So for example, if I change chi zero a bit here, some of the galaxies that were screened might suddenly become unscreened. They jump to a different sample, and they give you these slight jagged edges here. So with more data, we could actually smooth these out and get a much nicer plot. So in the last 5 minutes, I'd just like to tell you a little bit about some work in progress that's ongoing now. So one thing we're looking at is baryonic physics. So at the moment, N-body codes working on modified gravity don't include baryonic physics, and it's not known how modified gravity changes baryonic physics. It may very well be that it's unchanged. We don't know. We'd like to have some idea about that. So what happens when I put all of these modified gravity stars into unscreened galaxies? Well, you'd expect dwarf galaxies and voids to be brighter. You'd expect them to be slightly redder. And you'd expect the galaxies to be more chemically enriched. And you'd also expect the inferred age to be slightly older because you've cycled through more generations of stars. So to do this, I've been working with Baojun Li at Durham. And Baojun Li can predict the time dependence of chi-zero. So chi-zero changes slightly as a function of time because the field evolves on cosmological timescales. And the older argument was that if you observe at late times, you're not going to have a problem, but we wanted to check this just to make sure. So here I'm plotting the same thing as I plotted before, 10 to the minus 6 in f of r. The blue is general relativity, the red's a constant chi-zero, and the green is a very exaggerated time-dependent curve. So it's not a physically realistic one. I just wanted to exaggerate the features for demonstration purposes. And it turns out at very early times, your screens, chi-zero increases as a function of time cosmologically, and you follow the general relativity curve. But as you start to become unscreened, your curve interpolates to this one here. And it turns out if you use a slightly more realistic function of chi-zero, one which we can predict using excursion set methods, as long as you observe at low redshift, so when chi-zero is approximately constant value, because the stellar structure equations have to be satisfied locally, i.e. at every time, there is no difference between the gross properties, say the luminosity, the temperature, of a star that evolved under constant chi-zero and a star which evolved under time-varying chi-zero. The only thing that does change is things like the cumulative properties, so say the lifetime and the metallicity, and that's something we might have to take account of. So the plan is, now that we've got a code which can deal with modified gravity, we can use galaxy synthesis codes to produce lots of tracks, feed these into galaxy synthesizers, and we can hopefully extract some of the new properties like the change in color, the change in metallicity, and the hope is that we can then implement these into N-body codes, come up with some sort of prescription like they do for things like supernova feedback, and give us some sort of comparisons data. The other thing we've been looking at is scalar radiation and coupling actual changes in the fields to changes in pulsating stars. So it turns out when you do this, you get a set of coupled oscillators. So you might expect novel changes in the period luminosity relation, like beating effects and things like that. And it turns out the scalar field can source oscillations of the star, and the star oscillations can source scalar radiation. So you might expect something like this. And it turns out there's another interesting effect here as well. So there's a standard result in stellar astrophysics. If I take this polytropic equation of state, which I told you about earlier, p is proportional to the density, to some number gamma 1, then if gamma 1 is less than 4/3, this star is going to be unstable to adiabatic perturbations, and it's either going to collapse or explode. And this is what happens in type 2 supernovae, for example. All of the energy, all of the photons going to photodisintegrating ion core, they don't go into producing pressure, and you end up with gamma 1 of 4/3. As I said, this is still very early days and it's still work in progress, but what I'm finding is that actually modified gravity tends to make these stars more stable. So if you've got an unscreened star in modified gravity that's reasonably unscreened, the number that I'm getting at using a very simple model is 1.08, so we expect these might be slightly more stable.
This is more of this counterintuitive, wouldn't you expect them?
Yes, it is. It's something which puzzled me for a long time, because I would expect it to make it more unstable.
Yeah, because
and
more gravity.
Yeah, so I studied the equations carefully, and I think what's happening is, because these equations describe waves moving throughout the star, it's harder for these waves to propagate outside the screening radius because there's more gravity. And also there's a change in the gradients as well. So it turns out if you do a proper analysis, including all the radial effects, there's a stabilizing effect at first order and there's a destabilizing effect at third order. So the two balance. So the destabilizing effect changes this number here. And yeah, it's very counterintuitive, and I thought about it for a while. I think this is what's happening. But as I said, this is still very early days. I'd like to test this numerically. So I've got the modified equations. I'm currently in the progress of writing a pulsation code using modified equations. Then using the Lane-Nemden model, I can change gamma at will, and I want to see exactly where the instability kicks in. And also using Meser, I can get very realistic profiles, and hopefully we can then predict the new eigenfrequencies of Cepheids and get some better constraints.
So would you be able to then compare to things like the collapse supernova rate? I mean, I know the measurements are quite rough, but you could actually go and just...
Yeah, this is something...
This is a function of galaxies.
I was at a conference a few weeks ago, and this is something that someone at Durham mentioned to me, but I think until we get out proper numbers and things like that, we certainly think about that. As I said, this is a very, very simple model. It's a star of constant density which supports itself against gravitational collapse, so it may very well change if you use a more realistic model. It might.
I just wanted to ask a quick question about that idea. The core collapse in time conservative is core collapse, right? So the gravitational potential is very strong. So even though the star might be unscreened out in its outer layers, certainly by the time you get to the iron core, you're plenty screened, right?
Yeah, so...
And so that should proceed exactly like we think it goes now. And the outer layers of the star don't even know what happened until the shock, the rebound shock processes through them, right? So then how will the modified gravity in that context affect the type II supernova, besides maybe modifying elemental abundances because the break...
Yeah, that's the thing. So that's something that I still need to investigate. So it's not... until recently, MESA wasn't very good at very large stars. It was very hard to get to the core collapse stage. Now it's a lot better. So one of the things I need to do is decide exactly when the core is unscreened and when it isn't, and exactly what sort of values we could probe using this effect.
Not to mention, nobody can really get core collapse supernovas.
Yes, that's another effect as well. So yeah, I only mentioned type
two. Maybe that's the way to solve it.
Yeah.
But I think the gravity is stronger. Wrong direction.
Yes, yeah, the other thing is that we're interested in, the other reason we're looking about things like type II supernova is that when their outer layer gets blown off, the scalar charge changes very quickly, and this means you might see some sort of scalar radiation effect, so this is the reason we're interested in those. But as I say, this is still very early days, it's still something we need to think about a bit more carefully. Okay, so let me just summarize since I've used all my time. If you take modified gravity and you embed stars inside it, these stars show new novel features. They're brighter, they pulsate faster, and we can exploit these to actually place new constraints. So two things we've done, we've compared Water Maser and Tip of the Red Giant branch distances, and these allow us to sort out the old argument about whether the local group screens us or not and place a constraint. Chi0 is less than 10 to the minus 6. And we've been able to do a lot better than this by comparing Cepheid and Tip of the Red Giant branch distances. This actually constrains Chi0 less than 4 times 10 to the minus 7 for F of R theories, and hopefully I might have convinced you there's still some more interesting work to be done in this field, and we're still looking for new novel effects, and hopefully we can try and get all the way down and constrain all the way down to 10 to the minus 8. I should say that at less than 10 to the minus 8, you're now left with a theory where the only thing that's affected is very diffuse gas in the outer regions of dwarf galaxies. So at this point, your constraints really are quite tight. Thank you for your attention.
Major bullet points. So comparing the Cepheids and the Red Giant. Branch.
So sorry, the second point.
The Cepheid plus and Tip of the Red Giant. Branch.
Yeah.
So correct me if I'm wrong, but I thought the Cepheid period magnitude relation was empirically.
It is empirically determined. That's so this is something that we argued about. So it turns out because it's empirically determined.
And worse, isn't it empirically determined from main sequence fitting of globular clusters?
Yes.
The question then is, do you beg the question by using a main sequence distance estimate to determine the magnitude period relation, and then you compare the distance you get from those to main sequence distance estimates?
No. So this is something we argued about for quite a bit. So it turns out if you could compare this exactly as you would want to, then actually it turns out your change isn't in the periods because your period's fixed. Your change is in this other constant gamma. It's precisely because it's empirically calibrated that your change is in the period, because you've calibrated this thing on one period. If you then change the period, you should have calibrated in a different way, and you get your difference distance indicator comes from the fact that your calibration is off, not the fact that your period luminosity relation is wrong. It's something we thought about very carefully. The other thing I should say about this is that we could go a lot further if we could get better measurements of the mass. So it turns out that in modified gravity, because different mass stars are unscreened to different extents, higher mass stars, like 10 solar mass stars, show a much larger deviation in the calibration than low mass stars. And because we don't know what the mass of these Cepheids is, and because it's so uncertain, we can't get down to these levels. In theory, we could probe all the way down to 10 to the minus 8, because if we could say, this is my sample of Cepheids, I'm now going to split this into a sample of 10 to the 10 solar mass Cepheids. if I had enough of these would probe all the way down to 10 to the minus 8. And it's just the fact that we can't make these measurements that don't allow us to do this. And this is the reason you need to go to dwarf galaxy tests. But yes, it's the same. We always plead for more data because more data could easily improve these constraints. We really are very data limited. Yep.
I'm wondering, say, if you look at the early stars, a population of 3 stars, would it give a better constraint on this?
How early are population 3 stars?
I mean, say the early stars, you have a lower, I mean, you crash from a small black hole, right? You have a
mini. Oh, right, I see. Low mass stars are better tests because low mass stars are more effective. Bear in mind, you'd have to be able to resolve them, though. So if you could resolve them in dwarf galaxies and voids, then it would be perfect. The main problem is we cannot resolve main sequence stars in the halos of dwarf galaxies. We can only do it with Cepheids and tip of the red and red giant stars. And this is why we mainly focus on post-main sequence stars. And then this is what we're trying to do with by looking at galaxy synthesis, because you can't resolve individual stars, but cumulative effects should make a difference. And we started to estimate that, but it's nowhere near good enough to compare to observation.
Let's see, is it possible we can compare the INF and the ionization
history? Yeah, so someone spoke about the IMF. I think the problem is that the IMF, a lot of people wonder whether it's universal or not, and a lot of people say, can the IMF change? So I think there's a lot of degenerate effects there. And also, there's no analytic way of predicting it, which is the main problem with this. Yep.
You talked about in your constraints on Chi0, depending on whether or not the galaxy is in the void or not. But obviously, modified gravity would change your definition of the void.
Yes.
So have you checked for robustness?
Yes. So when they do the screening map, and I'm sorry, I think I may have accidentally skipped over it unintentionally. Let me just go back to it. So it turns out they impose two conditions, and these conditions. So essentially, they try and decide whether or not these galaxies, these things are screened or not.
Mm-hmm.
Where are we? Does it say screening map somewhere?
Oh,
there it is. Right, hang on. Sorry. Okay, brilliant. So the way they do this is they impose two conditions. They impose if phi Newtonian self is less than chi0, then the object is self-screened. If the external potential is less than chi0, it's environmentally screened. This condition here is robust. It's robust.
Yeah.
This one here is not as robust as you'd like it, because the true way of determining whether something's environmentally screened or not is to look at the comparison of the dynamical mass to the lensing mass. Unfortunately, you can't make this measurement. So the way they do it is they use n-body codes, and they use n-body codes including modified gravity. So the way they do it is they look at these cuts. They, using these n-body codes, they know which halos are screened or unscreened. They then put these cuts in, and they say, are we capturing whether the galaxies are screened or not? And it turns out they are. They then, because this is not a robust thing, they then put in extra source of systematics and extra sources of error. And it turns out this error is enough to kill you off at 10 to minus 8. So you can't get a screening map at 10 to minus 8 because the method is not robust enough. But 10 to minus 7, 10 to minus 6, and 10 to minus 5, they're quite confident. We were slightly conservative. So when we moved away from this, if we found that a lot of stars were suddenly jumping from being environmentally screened to not being environmentally screened, or were on the cusp, we didn't place constraints there. We were quite conservative in that respect. And there's a bit of argument between the group about that, but we were very conservative in the end. If you want to be less conservative, you could probably increase the constraints using the data, but for now, we want to be quite conservative.
Could it move the target fish? Is he able to carry on over lunch, Jim? Thank you very much.